Ladies and gentlemen, get ready to embark on a journey like no other. Welcome to the Glum Lot Podcast,
your go-to destination for a unique blend of recovery and discovery.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Mark. And in this podcast, we will endeavor to create a safe and uplifting space for our guests and listeners to share their stories with sincerity and a touch of humor.
Remember, we are not a glum lot. The Glum Lot Podcast is more than just a source of entertainment. It's a beacon of hope, proving that even in the darkest moments, recovery is possible. Every story we share carries the power to inspire positive change.
So buckle up, get ready to listen, and join us in discovering the strength that lies within every individual's journey. This is the Glum Lot Podcast, where humor meets hope. Okay, we are here on episode number 27 with Brett and Mark and the Glum Lot Podcast.
Oh, we are not glum. I'm sitting here trying to make faces at Mark to see if he'll break, and boy, he's too professional.
We are not glum. I wanted to remind our listeners to join our Facebook group. It's growing and growing.
It is.
The Glum Lot Podcast Facebook group. Join us.
Join us.
We'll be glad you did. Okay, so what's on your mind today, big guy?
I don't even know. Long weekend. We've had a, what's it called?
They call it here a midwinter roundup.
It's the yearly AA convention
they have in most cities.
Yeah, we just had ours.
I'll tell
you, it's the place where I first realized that, you know, you can seriously have fun in AA or whatever. You know, because you're in recovery doesn't mean you can't have some fun.
Good, clean fun.
AA.
The meetings are of prime importance, but there's a lot more to it.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to the fellowship part of it.
Oh, man, I could go on and
there's
on
the meeting before
on.
The meeting after the meeting, the activities that happen, the picnics, the get-togethers, the dances, the dinners, and this convention thing is a big deal here. They're bringing speakers from the outside.
Yeah.
They have an alkathon.
We had people from Jersey.
Yep, we have, there's a really cool room of artifacts.
Oh, yeah,
from the 100
neat.
Years
yeah.
of AA. Yeah, that was pretty
yeah,
neat.
Yeah, I saw my first edition.
We had
AA
book. One night they had a live band, another night they had a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you know what? It is fun, and people find out, especially new people, you can have a really good time without drinking.
Doing
the regular things
you
do.
And that's the whole basis of our podcast, isn't it? That we are
it
not
is.
A glum lot.
We
call
not.
It the glum lot because that'll get people's attention. But
yeah, it's kind of a joke, the glum lot.
Ooh,
a
funny.
Bummer. But we're not.
No.
Yay us.
No. Gee whiz.
What? Yeah. You know what? I think when people come in, they're glum. And first, you know, to a bit, at least as far as myself goes, I was very glum when I came in.
Well, we're full of shame and guilt.
I projected some of that glum on the people there. Like, oh, yeah, well, they must be glum too. First meeting, they were laughing their asses off.
They're laughing. The general public would be horrified about.
Oh, God, yes.
But they're laughing about, I was hanging out of the car when I was
getting accident. Let me tell you one really quick story from my first meeting. This was the story where I was like, okay, these are my people. This kid came on and he talked about trying to help a newcomer. He was giving him a ride to a meeting and he picked him up and then stopped at a convenience store to run and get a bottle of soda for the meeting.
Yeah.
And he runs in, he comes back out, and his car's gone. So the kid he was given a ride to stole his car.
Of course.
And everybody starts laughing. And I'm kind of like, jeez. Well, the next kid raised his hand. He said, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm the kid that stole his car.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh,
and he was
yeah.
sitting right next to him, and the guy was his sponsor. I'm like, holy shit.
Oh, yeah.
These is my people.
The follies. It's just great. It just is.
So,
there's hope. You don't have to be this way, this glum all the
that's
time.
Right.
That's
nope,
right.
No glummy. And so we have a guest today who I have never met, and you have never met.
God, I hope he's not glum.
And our friend Matt Y from episode number one has been helping us out. Booking some interesting guests outside of mine and Brett's personal realm, which is great
Very
for us.
Uncomfortable.
Great for us, though.
Okay, it is.
And
it
so
is.
We'd like to welcome our guest, Ricky.
Ricky!
Welcome to the Glum Lot Podcast, Ricky.
Hey. Hello, hello.
Hey, can we start with your sobriety date?
Well, my sobriety date is January 29th, 2019.
Okay, great. And we like to rewind back to the beginning, as
in
we
the beginning.
Always do. Do you remember your first encounter with alcohol?
Yeah, you know what's funny is someone brought up in a meeting the other day of like their first encounter. Oh, it was at the Roundup, right? And the guy goes, I had my first beer with my father at 6 years old. And
6 years you
know,
old?
We actually know this story. It's Bobby T.
That is the guy,
oh,
right?
Shit.
And side note, I relate to that gentleman with his most of his experience kind of runs very parallel to my story. And he said that, and this has happened like often in my sobriety where I like just forget stuff. And I'm like, wow, that actually what happened.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Something will click and it'll
remind
you.
Click and I'll be like, that is what happened. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was thinking, I would say I was probably 14 years old, right at the liquor cabinet of a friend's house sleepover. But then I think about it was actually more like Bobby's story.
Oh.
Where like I've had multiple sips of alcohol at a pretty young age.
Right. And you know what?
Playing bartender, do the deal.
That just reminded me doing that.
You know what though? At the time, it's so unremarkable. Of course we don't remember it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
And then we're faced with that teenage time when we're, okay, let's do something sneaky. Let's break into the liquor cabinet, see what we can get away with.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And that's what you did.
Yeah.
Tell us about
I say that a lot because I when I talk about, you know, my experience of drugs and alcohol, I say that I can remember every drug I ever did, right? And I've done them all in a very specific way, the way that a normal person would be like, oh, I remember my first bike that my mom got me.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, I remember the first hit of acid I got, you know? I remember the first time I did cocaine. And I do in the same exact way that someone remembers getting an art set for their 7th birthday. I don't remember that stuff, you know,
and I
because that's the importance, that's the value I place on drugs and alcohol. It's like it's even to this day, those were the things that I lived for, you know, like, wow, that's a new drug. I want it.
Right. That made an impact.
It
on
is
you.
An impact. Yeah. 100%.
So your first feelings of an alcoholic buzz, what was that like for you?
So I think I was around 14 or 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was like this outcast of a person. Number one, I was raised Jehovah's Witness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't celebrate holidays. And so like when I got to hang out with other friends of mine the same age, it wasn't because of birthdays. It wasn't because of the other things because I wasn't invited to those because I didn't celebrate. So like when somebody would be like, hey, Rick, you want to come hang out? I was all about it, no matter what it was. Right?
So did you feel different?
Yeah, you were instantly different.
Yeah, like I was, right? Yeah, like not even like what I perceived to be different as I was. On paper,
yeah,
I was different
than the rest
of
stuff.
Right. You know, 4th, 5th grade, someone's mom brings in a cake for their birthday. I have like my own little Debbie Snacks and Capri Sun by myself in the corner, not singing happy birthday.
Right, and as a kid, that has a big impact on your life. Right?
Absolutely.
You remove yourself from what is considered to be
a social group. And I recognize this because I had a friend that was Jehovah's Witness, and I remember this stuff. Yeah. Huh.
I don't know. So, 14 years old or so, me and two of my friends, we got a bottle of Seagram's. We drank the whole thing, and he lit his pants on fire and ran around the house, you know, and that was like...
And he wasn't even a liar.
Like, literally lit his pants on fire?
Well, yeah, he sprayed hairspray on his pants. He was a pyro, and he took a lighter and lit
it. That's what I thought.
And
we
were, like, running around the basement.
You're,
you know?
Fantastic.
And it was very innocent, you know, it was like...
But
hey,
do you remember the feeling, the inside feeling that it gave you?
I don't relate to when people talk about that euphoric of like that first drink, whether I blacked it out and I choose not to remember it, or it's just like it didn't work like that for me. You know, like I remembered that I felt a part of, and I was hanging out with like maybe two people I didn't like talk to as much in school, but I was there with the guys, and we had this liquid that made us all the same at that moment.
Nice.
You know,
nice
what I mean?
Way to put that.
It is a good way to put it, yeah. So from there, what happens in your life?
Continue to do it as often as I can, right? And like around that age, I think like the religion starts to like slip out of my mother was the one that practices Jehovah's Witness. My dad was what I believed to be at the time an abusive alcoholic. Whether I believe that today or not is different, right? What I watched and what I seen and what I heard was a guy that drank a lot and liked to be violent, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then my mother was like this angelic woman who practiced this very strict religious views and didn't smoke and didn't drink and didn't swear and had a regimen of going to work, taking care of the family, and going and practicing a religion.
So when you were growing up, was there a lot of conflict in the home because of these two very different lives?
Whether they were because of the ways of life or like my dad was this guy who you know, my parents were 19 when they had me, and my dad was still 19, you know?
Yeah,
and
he was a kid.
And he drank, and he liked to fight, and he was, like, good at it. You know, guys would call up my father and be like, hey, you want to come? We got a situation, you know? And he would leave the house for a few hours, fight, come back. And, like, that was, like, I remember it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on top of a bunch yin and yang.
Right.
It seems like.
Internal conflict from, like, you know, a young age. And I don't think I ever thought about it like that, right? Like, that I was, like, had these... a tug of war, and I was the flag in the center, you know, of like different ways
of
life.
For a lot of us, I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I thought the way I was growing up was the way everyone was growing up. I thought it was perfectly normal until I got a little older and I started seeing how other families were. And I'm like, you know, maybe the way I grew up wasn't so fucking normal. Maybe it was a little skewed, you know. But at the time, I was all in. That's the way people grow up,
right?
You know? So, you're fitting in more with alcohol, and then at some point, do drugs enter the picture?
Yeah, but around, like, so my parents start to, like, allow me to drink around senior year.
Okay.
Like, like, allow me to start having people at the house, right, mm-hmm. and parties. And so senior year, I throw a party that was, like, every school district around, you know.
Dang.
And the cops are called. My parents get... multiple counts of endangering the welfare of a child.
Oh,
like you did
serious,
it up.
Some serious things, you know? And that was, like, I did it because I, like, I wanted to be a part of it. I wanted to be the man, you know? That's my story.
It definitely sounds it. Multiple districts.
Right. And that was, like, my story, I think, in continuing into sobriety of things I have a hard time with, right, is, like, wanting to be the guy.
Yeah.
Not a man amongst men, but the
man. I strive to be the guy. Know?
So and, did your parents always make you the guy? Growing up?
No, I think, like, my relationship with, like, my mother and I think father is, like, I was, like, pretty, like, a good kid. Like, I didn't get in trouble, and I was just what I thought, like, pretty normal, you know, until, like, yeah, there was violence between me and my father at probably 12 or so, and it was abusive. And then, like, as I started, like, throwing these parties and things, like, it got more abusive and things got... almost up until the day I stopped drinking, you know, like it never really went away.
Right. It was just crazy.
Yeah.
So you are a senior. You have this big bash. Things get crazy. What happens from there forward?
I still like to throw parties. My parents had like a camp. And when they were at camp on the weekends, I threw parties, you know, every weekend.
Did there start to be consequences in your life as a result of drug and alcohol use?
Not yet, really.
Yeah.
You know, like, I got away with things that other people didn't, you know? How do I say? I guess, like, I'm my dad's Native American. I look white. I'm white, you know? I'm a male. Like, there's some privilege there with, like, being in a suburban area where, like, we had fights, cops would get called, and, like, we'd get away with it, you know? There's a lot of those kinds of privileges that I didn't see then that I know today were ultimately privileges.
Yeah.
And I didn't get the consequences that maybe other people did.
Okay, yeah.
Doing what a lot of other people, maybe even my age, were doing, you know?
So the drug and alcohol use continues.
Yeah, 17, I find cocaine, and that was it, you know? Right. Like, a game on. And it was, like, up to that point, I had, like, some health issues. I had, I was wearing, like, heart monitors. There was a lot of different issues going on that they didn't know. I had high blood pressure since I was 14. And, I remember my first time doing cocaine. And, like, my friends are doing it at the house. And my one buddy finds out that I'm doing it. And he loses his shit. And he's like, you can't do that. And he takes our shit. And he's, like, trying to hide it on us. So we grab it from him. And we're running down the road. Something happens. A cop is chasing us, so we hide the coke. We get it back, and we're like, dude, we can't tell this kid, like, that we have cocaine, you know, because he won't let us do it. And that was, like—
He was concerned about you, rightfully so.
Right, and at 17—
You had to run from that shit, yeah.
I throw that to the wind and say, we got to protect the powder. Protect it so we can do it and enjoy it the way we want to, which seemed, like, harmless. And I believe it was harmless, you know? Like, it was just us. We weren't, like, putting other people's lives in jeopardy. And that was it. And kind of continued on from there of, like, you know, all my friends were working and we made money and that was what we did.
So when you got together, you'd get a gram or two or whatever happened, get some beers and get down to it. So did this any of your health issues become exacerbated by this use?
Not at that time.
Yeah. You're still young enough and healthy enough where it wasn't a big deal. Yeah. It wasn't a concern, right?
No.
And so your life's going along. You're in your late teens, early 20s. You feel like you're living a fairly normal life. Everybody's getting together. You're all working. You're all partying hard, right?
Right. But I also start to, like, separate. I think, like, a lot of some people did it in college. I did it, like, throughout the community. I started, like, finding other people, whether it was, like, people that I was just, you know, the art community and the music community. Those are like my people and not maybe like the whatever, you know, I played sports in high school and stuff, but I could never find my place, right? Like some people like, oh, I'm a jock. I'm a creative. And I like hung out with people with everyone had different backgrounds and I wasn't able to like label who I was.
Right, you didn't fit into any niche.
Not really, you
okay,
know?
Yeah.
And so I started to like find like the jam band hippie music community at around the same age, around 18, you know, and that's like where more recreational drugs start
right,
to come
there's
in.
Right, there's a drug element with that.
Right, and I liked it.
Which you were comfortable with.
Which I was comfortable with, and I was willing to, like, try anything. And I enjoyed the music, and I enjoyed the freedom of, like, in a field, listening to music, you know, the whole, all of that comes with it, you know? Mm-hmm. The women, the drugs, sex, drugs, rock and roll.
Yeah.
Like, that was what I wanted, but I wasn't a musician, you know.
Okay.
Right, and I liked the scene.
But you were a consumer of that.
Absolutely,
so
appreciated it,
and you liked that lifestyle.
Yeah.
So you fall right into it. It feels natural to you.
Yeah, and I start to travel and go to
people
shows.
Like you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you fit right in.
You finally belonged.
Right.
So you start to travel with a.
I like went to shows all over the country.
Yeah.
And
nice.
You know, throw your clothes in a backpack and find some drugs and
hit the road
to town.
Nice.
And that was like. Now, you know, I had, like, my friends I grew up with, and they, like, didn't understand what I was doing, and some did, and some didn't, and it was, like, just different. You know,
yeah,
like,
it's that time where everybody's taking their own path anyways.
Right.
Yeah. So you become, like, is it, like, Grateful Dead type?
Yeah, absolutely. Rock? Fish, yeah. The Dead, Mo,
nice.
You know, bands like that.
Right, and there is a community that travels with that.
Absolutely.
Right? And you became part of that.
Absolutely.
Very drug-involved community.
Absolutely.
But also a fellowship of its own, really.
Yeah,
you know, just that it revolves around partying and music,
and a lot of love there,
right?
Right,
belonging.
A lot of love
at home.
There,
right? And that's like a common thread in my story up till today, right? Is like the looking for something that whether I thought I didn't get it or I did get it, it starts to come in different shapes, forms, people.
And you know what's
energy.
Really interesting about that? You know, you can look at that lifestyle and say, "Well, that's a bad lifestyle." But you know what? The drug part of it may be bad, but there's a lot of good there. And that good can live on in sobriety, and that a lot of these bands have a sober following that is very close.
And I'm a part of that stuff today.
Yeah, and Billy Strings has that, right?
Yep.
What does he call his? What do they call his group?
I can't think of Billy Strings their name, but like,
isn't there a
like,
thing
Fish has the Fellowship PH,
and the Dead has something.
The Dead is called the Wharf Rats.
Yeah.
The Yellow Balloon is the generic name for jam bands. If you go to a show and there's a Yellow Balloon, you sit at during the set. There's always a meeting. And,
yeah, that to me, that's so fantastic.
And I've been to a bunch of them.
That's just proof of what you just said, though.
Yeah.
You know, that you
there's
can still do this
there.
Sober.
Right.
Yeah,
it's,
I know for like the Billy Strings thing, you get a button, right? Or a sticker or something.
Sticker.
And that identifies you as a member of this sobriety community.
Yeah.
And you make fast friends with that,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I just think that's fantastic.
Well, what's good about that, whether it's like if someone's seen you with like a yellow sticker on, and like this is my experience at a Billy Strings show, was someone just came, pat me on the shoulder, hey, are you good? And I was like, yeah, I never met the guy.
Oh, that's
like,
amazing.
You know, they're just
it really is cool.
Checking in on you. And the thing about that, of like that environment, is that it's not like related to a specific 12-step group, right? It is related to like people that want to come together to
caring about people,
right? And like they have a problem with drugs, alcohol, but it's not particular, you know.
Yeah.
So like,
yeah.
And it teaches you a lot of like the judgmental stuff, right? Is like this guy just cares about me, and he knows like if he see me with a needle in my arm, he'd probably like try to save my life.
Yeah, but you're not there yet. What we're talking about.
No,
yeah.
No.
Let's get
early
back
on.
To it.
I did interject a little early on that one. But.
No, so, but that's important because like
it
that,
is.
Is,
it is.
That is like my life has come full circle.
Yeah,
like, where
right.
I'm involved with that stuff today, you know. And if I look back to the rest of my life, like I would have never thought that was a thing.
Right.
You know,
I don't think a lot of people out there that listen to this podcast know that. I mean, I didn't know until I started talking to some younger people that this is like a really kind of a big thing.
It's massive.
These shows, yeah, it's huge.
And with social media, it's all over. They all have their own groups, and they look for people to chair meetings. That's what they look for.
And that is fantastic.
So I'm going to the show. I'm going to be in Boulder, Colorado. Can I be a part of the table? Can I chair the meeting? And they'll say, yeah, meet us at X location at 9:30 at set break and chair the meeting. And that's all you do.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe we don't spend a whole lot of time on the Drunkalug on this one. I don't know. So well, maybe we'll
get a little bit of a story.
I'll share a little more of like.
Yeah, yeah.
So I start to, I get into a relationship, and this girl that, so I don't know, 21 or so, her brother introduces me to a local music venue, the owner, and I become, I just start doing some side work for him, you know? And I become, in that scene. Now I'm in the scene. Not a musician. I still like cocaine, and I like to drink. And at that time, I started dabbling with recreational drugs, ketamine.
Special K.
Everything but heroin at this time. Okay. Let's just say that, you know?
Anything
but heroin and... No, see, I used to believe that. I thought I never liked opiates, right?
Yeah.
And then I look back at my story again, and I was like, I took my first hydro when I was 17, doing roofs with my father. And, I used them very – to say, oh, it's just something to help me work, you know? But I wasn't a heroin addict, you know? Mm-hmm. That's my perception. I think that was my perception for a couple years in sobriety. It was like, no, I didn't do that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but then you look back, you're like, well, actually, I did.
Yeah, and I'll get, around that time, 21, 22, I start to really, fall in love with this venue. I started to work there, and I didn't know at the time, but I started to put a lot of value on the job I was doing because it had all the things I wanted. It had the girls, it had the music, it had the drugs,
and now you
were
really a part of it. You may not have known it had an instrument or anything, but you were a part of it.
Well, and the man part comes out, right? Like people are like, hey, Rick, can I get a ticket tax show? And I'm like, yeah, I got
you. You the man.
Right? Mm-hmm. And they tip you in some drugs and they tip you into this.
Nice.
Well, at the same time, I'm taking money out of a guy's pocket, you know, because I'm letting them in. And again, that stuff's not, that's not how I thought back then.
Sure.
I wasn't thinking that that's that's stealing or whatever it is, you know. I just didn't
it's
think
part of the deal.
That's the deal. Like, yeah, everyone does it, whether they do or not. You know, I guess you don't realize that till you start to take a look at your inventory and all those things. And that's maybe not how everyone. Whether everyone does do it, they might be able to, but they don't put themselves in the situation that I do when I go to the extreme.
So does the progression of the disease start to
around that time?
Yeah.
So I had this relationship for 4 years, and I was like, okay, I'm going full-blown work for this venue, and I'm done with this girl. And that was, the first time I made a decision to pursue what I thought was, and I'm not, making all this money. I'm not, at this level where it would make sense that maybe some other people thought about leaving a relationship and chasing a career. That's not, that wasn't my motive. Right. My motive was, I like music.
Right.
There's more attractive women.
So right, so it's it's more like you. I want to be able to freelance at this point.
100%.
I don't want to be tied down.
Right. So, to anything or
so
any.
You wrong. Basically wanted freedom.
And I got it. And that was when it started to come hard and fast. The addiction part of.
So the freedom was killing you.
Yeah, it did. It did. And so I start to get involved in the music scene, and there's the drugs, there's everything I wanted, there's the booze. And I was a hard worker, and I did the things that were asked of me. And I, also partied hard, you know? My first experience of, getting in trouble for, getting caught doing cocaine was, a funny one to me, you know? I was at the venue I was working at, and there was a show, and, it was done. It was sold out, and we were, drinking the entire time. You know, I was running the venue and bartending, and I was supposed to close up, and I decided that wasn't really important, whether my position or not.
Show must go on.
Right, and the other manager called me in the next day, and he was like, why do you keep going into a bathroom with another guy? And I was like, and I had to be honest, and I was like, I was doing a lot of coke, I don't know, you know, and he was like, I get it. He's like, but you can't, that's not how you should handle that, how you should do it, you know? He goes, and then you left early, and you just took the money and left. I was like, well, I was with this girl. And he's
always
like,
he's like, you work for us.
Right.
It's not, you don't own this venue.
Right. Yeah. And that was, and I was able to, I tell you enough that you need to hear that I say I'm being honest, and I get emotional, and I probably put like some sort of like sad face on, and I get away with it.
Right.
You know?
Manipulation.
And you've got some charisma, and these people like you.
Right.
And so you're going to use that as currency.
100%. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I did, and I continued to do that. From there on, like, life got like hard and fast, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I went from relationship to relationship, still being in the venue I was working at. I had some opportunities, you know, selling merch across the country at some, like, you know, large music festivals with some bigger name bands in the same genre that I like. And, like, I had opportunities, you know? Like, now opportunities are popping up because people see that I'm good at what I do. And now here comes, like, some the circumstances and, like, the what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know, like, things start happening, you know, mm-hmm. as a result of, like, the decision. Repercussions. There you go. And I was running a VIP at a music venue, and I take so I take this guy's son, who the guy owns a big company. He's like, yeah, have a fun with my son, you know, like, get him drunk and take the boys out. And I took that to the next level, started doing a lot of ketamine, started doing a lot of cocaine. Don't know how many hits of acid I took. And, like,
oh boy.
Next thing I know, I come back to the tent, and I'm out. I'm on it, you know? I'm on it. And I, like, hit a guy with a golf cart that had my name on it. It was, like, Ricky, you know? Like, so everyone knew it was
you?
Me.
Well, it was,
yeah,
Ricky.
Was that guy? Who's
it's
Ricky?
It's imprinted on his ass.
Right. So, and, like, I go home the next day after, like, having a really intense trip. Like, it was bad. You know, they tie me to a tree. Things are bad. And
No, we aren't gonna let you get by that one.
Okay. Yeah, but I was juggling knives. Like, I found
so they're like,
I don't know how to juggle.
Is there any footage?
No.
So just in order to save you from yourself, they say we better tie this guy to a
tree. Which is what they used to do in the '70s, like at dead shows and stuff. They're oh, you took the brown acid.
We're freaking out.
Right, and I was losing it. On top of all the other drugs I was on, you know, I was like digging my hole, I guess, in the RV, trying to get out inside. You know, I was just on another level. Didn't work. And long story short is I go home. I take, like, I hydrate up back to my parents' house, and they call me up to come back to the festival to finish running it, you know.
What, and they really wanted to see more of that stuff.
So what happened was I get a ride out there. And both of the promoters go, Ricky, you can drink, no drugs. Like, we want you, you know, like, because we were crushing it at the bar, and it was, like, a big hit, this tent that I created that had lights. Like, it looked good, right?
So
and
you're doing a great job.
Yeah.
But. You're about to kill someone, so
right.
Let's.
And I'm just, like, I'm representing people in a company, and I don't care, right? I don't care. Like, I'm just like, I'm going to have fun.
You're bigger
too.
Than that.
You're right. And so I go back, and within 15 minutes, this guy, as I literally just told a friend of mine, I'm not going to do any drugs. And I go and grab a drink and mingle. And everyone's like, man, that was pretty intense the other day. And I was like, yeah. And a guy hands me, you know, like a softball of cocaine. After I just told the guy I wasn't going to do any drugs, I go to a porta potty and I throw it down my nose. And I'm like, game on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. That was, like, how I lived. And, like, and that was, like, my first relationship long-term that I left. Like, she didn't like cocaine, and I would tell her I wouldn't do it, and I would always do it. I never not did it.
Well, there were knives flying. Of course she didn't like it.
It is hard to say no.
Right.
And you're in that element that's so exciting and so chaotic, and we love that shit.
I do.
And so you're working basically what is your dream job.
Yeah.
And part of the element of that is the drugs and alcohol,
well, I
right?
ruined it because of that experience. I had an opportunity to go tour for a band, pretty big level, being their merch seller. And another employee told the tour manager, you can't hire Ricky. He's a liability. And I was. And it was from this experience, you know.
Mm.
And, like, people didn't know the extent of my drug use, you know. Like, with that first relationship I talked about, that was, like, my first experience with heroin at 23. Meanwhile, I had fentanyl patches in my mouth almost on the daily. You know, I was getting patches, and I was putting them in my chewing tobacco, and I would walk around, you know, high on opiates almost daily, you know, with, like, I have a lot of experiences, you know, and stories about that where people thought I was just had a bad back or I was sick when I was, like, really detoxing, and I'd be like, oh, I'll come back, give me a minute. And I remember at Christmas, my parents were at my girlfriend at the time's family's house, and I turned pale white. My mom's like, is your back acting up? And I was like, I don't think so. I looked in the mirror, and I'm pale. Mm. And I'm like, okay, it can't be it. You know, I'm like trying to deny that I have a problem with opiates, you know. So I go home, I go to my little box of tricks, and I chop out a line of coke, and I'm like, nope, that didn't work. Take a glass of whiskey, that didn't work. Oh. And I see the fentanyl, and I'm like, I put one in my mouth, and instantly, like, I got color in my face, you know. It was like that day, like, that I knew I was physically addicted to this drug. And, like, that's what people talk about, right? You know, at that time I'm 25, and, like, I fit the demographic of a white 20-year-old male that is being affected by the opiate epidemic in the country, right? And, like, I kind of, like, you know, related it to that. And but I also had all these other vices that it was easy for me to kick that because I did so much cocaine and I drank so much. I drink every day, you know, whether it was, like, casually at the bar, have, you know, a few and a couple of shots, or it was during.
But there was a moment of brief clarity.
Yeah, that, like, I don't want to be a heroin addict.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, no, you don't like coke. You know, it was like, you don't want to, like, put a needle in your arm.
That was it. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was awful, right? But the other stuff's not bad.
No.
So what happened?
So I, like, you know, that was 24 or so. So then I'm doing the shows and all this stuff. And I am definitely messing with heroin and opiates a lot more frequently because that's how I have to live. I got to go to work, so you take an Adderall, speed up, your back hurts because you're all messed up, you take some more opiates, you know. And I use drugs like this one worked for this one worked for that, drinking worked for this. Drinking was like the social thing, so I could put myself around certain
people.
That
was acceptable.
That's
for
acceptable.
People to see.
Cocaine's pretty acceptable in like the bar community that I was around and like the party community. And I was very chameleon-like, you know? Like, around that time, I start to I lose the job at the venue. I left on my own, but I was doing some bad stuff, you know? Wasn't the best employee anymore, you know? And, like, relationships are going out the window. Around that time was the first person. The only person that's ever called me an alcoholic in my life was at that time.
Okay. So, but the world around you can see is starting to crumble a bit, right? There are cracks.
Absolutely. And I was, like, just pushing 30. So I think I was, like, 28. I got sober at 31. Yeah, so 28, like, things are starting to spin a little out of control, but I'm, like, managing, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe managing.
You think you're managing.
Yeah,
was like, at this point, were people not recognizing the amazing Ricky?
People still, like, thought I was a good guy, you know?
Okay.
Like, there was, like, as far as I know, like, I wasn't the guy that was just, like, going into a bar and, like, being an asshole, you know? Mm-hmm. I like to fight a lot. I did that a lot, and that was definitely part of my story. But I got away with it, you know? I would just go, and I would get away with it. I didn't have those repercussions. Yeah. I didn't have, like, the arrest. I didn't have DWIs. Got out of them. Not that I didn't do them. You know, 21 years old, I crashed into where I grew up. I hit a bridge, a telephone pole, a fire hydrant, and a tree. Took them all down. And that was
in one swoop?
One car accident.
Yeah.
August, turned 21 in July, and then a month later I got in that accident, and I didn't get any tickets.
Hmm.
You know, and that was like,
you know, it's funny,
on.
But a lot of times when people tell their stories, it's those getting away with things that draw them further down.
Absolutely.
You know?
Not being held accountable.
Yeah, not being held accountable, exactly. So you're at this point in your life, you're approaching 30, people are starting to kind of move away a little bit, your jobs are starting to crumble a little bit. What happened?
Yeah, I would say fast forward to, like, the last relationship I'm in, the girl who I thought I was in love with, who I was, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Sure.
And she asked me a serious question of, like, hey, like, you don't have a car anymore. You're bartending, you're, like, doing concrete. Like, I'm working, you know, I'm probably making decent money with a combination of all these different incomes. And but you don't have anything, and you're not contributing. Like, what's the deal? How do we, like, move forward from this? What's the plan? And I told her all of the shit she wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And 4 months later, she was out the door, right? And that was, like, game on, and that was it, right? That was... I was working at a bar where she was like, that's a bad idea. There's too much, like, and it was this bar, and there was a lot of, like, people with some money. And so what they could do and what I could do were two different things, right? These guys were able to recreationally use cocaine and drink hard, maybe they don't have a problem and their lives look to me, especially a guy who's like crashing wherever he can, they look like they got their shit together.
Right.
They're driving nice cars. They got nice shoes and clothes on, and they always got $1,000 worth of coke in their pocket, you know? And I wanted that, but I didn't want to put the work in. I didn't want to save up. You want a nice car, you got to save up for it, you know? And I didn't want to do that stuff, but I wanted to party the same way they did.
Yeah, but you weren't capable of living that kind of
absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely.
So when she walked out, what was that like?
When she walked out, things got real, real hairy, you know?
Were you mad at her? At first?
Yeah, there was some circumstances that I thought, like, I blamed her. Like, you're cheating on me. I walked into a house, like, I was going to see another girl. I walked all the way to our old house, and I had a key still. So, essentially, I broke into the house, even though I had the key, and I seen her with another guy, and I played it off like I was just drunk, which I was, you know, and I probably didn't sleep more than a couple hours in a few days. And we got into it, you know, and I grabbed this kid and I'm like, I'm going to kill him and kick his ass. And something said, like, don't hurt him. You know, I remember picking him up and I didn't do anything.
Were the cops called?
Cops weren't called.
Okay.
Damn.
Again, you know, and like that point on, it was like, I'm just going to party up into. So that was probably in November. I went to my first AA meeting in March. Right after that.
How did you get to your first AA meeting?
So I have a friend of mine since high school or since elementary school, and her wife got sober the year before. And so I reached out, and this was like, I'm still going to try to get this girl back.
So you knew that this guy was getting his life together a little
bit. I knew, like, I was like, hey, I need some help. And so she brought me to my first meeting at the 5:30, and I went. And I would go. And I'm still bartending.
Right? Now, did you raise your hand and say, yeah, this is my first meeting? Have a first-step meeting?
Yep.
Did you hear things at the meeting where you're like, holy shit, that's part of my story. Yeah, I can relate.
I don't remember it.
Okay. All right.
You know? And so, I didn't stay sober from that point.
Okay.
That was my first meeting. Right. I would go. I was going to, like, the young people's meetings, and I was hanging out. And I remember, like, and I share this a lot because I think it's important, is, like, I remember going and hanging out with people. Around, so I'm like 29, around my age, a little younger, and they're going out to dinner after the meeting, and they're hanging out, and I'm not drinking or using, and I would go home, I'm back at my parents' house, and I'm like grabbing the big book and going, how the fuck is this book gonna keep me sober? And because I didn't believe it, I didn't know. I knew, like, when I was with these people after the meeting,
it's
I didn't drink
book.
Or use. How is this book gonna keep me sober? And I share that because, like, it does. You know?
Bro.
And like, and I didn't know that. I didn't. And so I got a sponsor.
So wait, you were going out to dinner with these people?
Yeah. We would leave the meeting. We'd go out to dinner. I would put a month together and then I would like drink and I would lie. And sometimes I'd raise my hand. Sometimes I wouldn't.
Yeah.
This continued on. There was like some attempts of suicide in between there.
Wow.
This continued on until Cinco de Mayo. And I knew this date because I made plans with people in the fellowship, some friends of mine who are my friends to this day. And they're like, hey, you coming for a hike with us? And somehow I came into some extra money and I went and I bought some nice clothes. And like, that's like, you know, the image. I'm that image guy. I need to look a certain way, especially if I'm gonna go out. And I went and I was like, I told them a lie. And they knew it. Like looking back on it now, they knew what was going on.
But you're in a really inside. You're in a very dark place.
Right. Yeah.
You're like a tornado. You know, every once in a while you'd touch down, and then you'd be up there spinning around.
Right. I like the feeling of having that same communal group and the love, and like people telling me how much they enjoy their life without a drink and a drug. But like, I really didn't get a taste.
But you weren't
of that.
Used to belonging in that sense.
No.
Plus, you're not there yet.
Not there yet. And so I go out on Cinco de Mayo, and like things were first day back, like really out. Yeah, I drank and did some drugs in between, but I was out. And I didn't go back until I got sober this time and to a meeting. In between that time, I seen multiple people from Alcoholics Anonymous at different places. You know, like my creator was
keep
like,
keep running
hey.
Into them.
I go to a wedding, these two women. I go to their wedding. Their wedding was in November, and I didn't sleep for a week. They were super good friends of mine. I get off this bus. I'm covered in cocaine. My eyes are a mess, and I kid you not, the first people I see are seven people from Alcoholics Anonymous.
Damn.
Not like anyone else. Hey, Rick, what's up? And I'm like, nothing. You know?
Wiping
and,
his face
just
off.
Trying to like
maintain.
You know, you got a suit on, you look good, try to feel how you look, but I didn't, you know, I was just trying to keep it together as much as I could, which it wasn't really, like, that was a bad, bad wedding for me, you know?
And so people knew, right?
They knew. Everyone knew.
Did anyone confront you?
Nope. Not even.
Let you do your thing?
Not even the person that brought me to my first meeting, and, okay. I thank her for that, you know? And, like, you know, she's a part of my life today. Her and her wife, they are my friends, some of my closest friends, and, like, they let me just go. You know, she did bring me to, there was, at that meeting I used to go to, there was a kid, he picked up 3 years, or 3 or 4 years, he got a good job, got a new car, and then he overdosed and died, you know. Mm. And she brought me, and that was in September, and she, I remember the day was rainy, and there was a lot of young kids at the funeral, and the gentleman that was just here, he was talking, or he was there, and I remember her bringing me, and I don't know if it was her way to slightly see, like, hey, this is where you're going. You know, this is where you're going. Yeah. And I went to it, and I didn't. You know, I went out. I think I had darts that night, and I went out after, and I picked up my darts, and I went to the bar, and I drank, you know. Yeah. It did nothing, you know, like, can't scare a drunk. That's my first sponsor told me.
Now, when you're in this place, and so you get a little bit of AA, you got the fellowship, but you're still unable to stop, that's a hell of a place to be.
Right.
That's the hell of drinking, the hell of not drinking.
Especially when people are catching you, too.
Right. It fucking tears you up.
Oh, God,
man.
That's the worst.
It's so dark.
And that's, like, why I think my belief of, like, it's not just that, right? It has to be more. You have to have, it is up to the individual, the willingness, the whatever the circumstances that brought you there, that emptiness you have. Like, you know, fast forward to the last 2 weeks of my drinking, the last day I remember, you know, I get back, I'm at my parents' house, I'm 31 years old, and I've been up for weeks. You know, and I took my shoes off. I don't still know to this day why I took my shoes off before I got in the house. It was snowing. It was January, and I, like, threw them in the snowbank, and I walked to my parents' house. I believe, when I think about it now, was, like, I wore these same shoes for 2 weeks, and they were gross, and I was gross.
You kept them on the entire time?
The entire time. You know, I'm in houses, in bars, in trap houses, smoking crack. You know, like, my life is at the bottom. I hate my life, you know, and I throw the shoes away. And I go upstairs to my parents' house, and I take out the rest of all the – I had a box of drugs, and they had different drugs in there. And I take it out, and I start doing them. And I had a bottle of whiskey, and it was, like, a really expensive bourbon. And it's kind of funny. Like, that was my last drink that day. And I took a gun out, and I was positive I was going to – I grabbed my dad's shotgun on my parents' bed, and something said, like, you can't kill yourself on your parents' bed, you know. And I didn't. And I called a friend who I knew, and I didn't even have a phone at this time. Like, I was just like, I used, like, the house phone of my parents, and she was like, I'm calling the Salvation Army, that's where I went, and we'll see if they can get you in. She calls back, and they're like, here's the deal, it's a Christian program, it's 7 months, you got to shave your face and cut your hair. And, like, I'm like, that might be challenging, but I was willing to do whatever, you know. Like, I just put a gun in my mouth.
Yeah, you're,
you know,
fucking desperate.
And she sends over this guy, a friend of hers, and they brought me to the 12 o'clock meeting, the noon meeting, and that was my first meeting back. And I was still, like, high and drunk, and that's why they couldn't accept me into the rehab to the next day. And I remember that meeting. I remember the people. I don't remember, like, what they said, but I knew I was hurt, you know? Like, I knew what I looked like, even though I couldn't, like, see myself. I knew I was an absolute mess. And, like, that, I don't know if it was desperation or, like, there was emptiness, you know? Like, drugs and alcohol, as much as I wanted to keep drinking and using, I knew they weren't going to work. Like, there wasn't a drug in the world that was going to make me feel better at that moment in time. I just knew it. Like, I knew it, like, in the deepest
parts of me. You know, that is the turning point at which a lot of people either do kill themselves.
Yeah.
Or they just end up having to surrender and saying, I can't do it. And that's the point I got to where I was just like, the last time I came back, because I did the same thing you did. I, you know, I was drinking and whatever in between for months. When I came back, I just raised my hand. I started crying. And I said, I don't know how to do this. I can't do this anymore. I just don't know how to do it. And at that point, I was willing to take anybody's advice. I was willing to do anything because I didn't have much of a choice.
Right.
You know, I just couldn't do it anymore. Right. So you go to this program at the Salvation Army.
And so it's strict. There's no cell phones, which I didn't have one. I weighed 150 pounds with the clothes on my back. And I went there at 1 o'clock, and I go through the process. And they take a before picture. They tell me the rules, and I did them, you know. I also, like, was a guy that wasn't into, like, causing a scene, you know. Like, yeah, I fought people. I did these. But I wasn't, like, into causing scenes, you know. I kind of just followed the rules. Right. I did what I wanted to, but, like,
You flew under the radar.
Flew under the radar. And I had the ability to do it, you know, whatever that is. And so I got through this program when other people, like, I'm talking, there's a lot of people. I get there in the winter, and there's 50 men and 30 women, and, like, there's new people every day. Someone would leave, someone would come. Someone, you know, like, the turnover rate was unbelievable, you know. And I'm just doing what they ask of me, and, like, you had to work for your stay, you know. So you go do a work program, and I would work from 7 to 4. And
so you really have to surrender.
Yeah, like, in there you're forced to. But that's, like, my first rehab, too. You know, most of these people are what they looked like, what I thought an addict or an alcoholic was, homeless.
Right.
Needles in the arm. You know, like the 60-year-old man that hasn't had a house in 30 years. Like, that's what everyone looked like, you know, or what I thought they looked like, you know. And so I, after 28 days, you take a drug test, and if you are clean, you can go to a meeting or just leave the facility. So I left, and I went
to... So you're locked down that whole time?
The entire time. No phone. You couldn't use a phone for 2 weeks. My parents didn't know, like, how I was doing. Mm-hmm. No one did. And so I get to go to my first meeting, 28 days sober, which is probably one of the longest times ever, you know?
Yeah.
Really, no drink, no drug. Detoxed in there. I was dirty for every drug. So my body was, you know, I didn't sleep for that whole month, I don't think. I'm hallucinating. I think there's, like, things happening to me. It was, like, a really scary, hard place to be. And I'm in a different, like, it's almost like prison, you know?
Yeah.
To me.
A medical doctor there that's taking care of you?
No.
So you're just on your own.
On my own.
Detoxing, horrible.
I was eating so much, like, that I would throw up because I was 150 pounds, and I haven't really eaten or taken care of myself in months. And so I go to a meeting, and I meet a guy at the noon meeting because I knew that meeting existed, and he offered to pick me up the next day to go to a meeting. And that guy was my first sponsor for 2 years, you know, and he picked me up every single day for 7 months.
And you were a complete stranger to this guy.
Yep.
And he was willing to do that.
And he followed the direction of his sponsor.
You know what's funny? I did the same thing that guy did for another guy. Where I would go to the Salvation Army where he was living, and I would pick him up every day. And him and I are still close today. He did end up going back out, and now he's back in. But, yeah, it's – you know what? I can say this as the guy who picked the guy up. That did me more good than just about anything else at the time. And it was early in sobriety. I had maybe a year. But I made it my thing to go pick him up every day. And we'd go to a meeting, and we'd go out after. And then I'd drop him back off in the city at the Salvation Army.
Right.
It was great for me.
And I, I didn't, being on the other side of the coin is, like, I didn't know, like, what this was, like, why this guy was doing it, you know?
I mean, it's like, so foreign anywhere.
Yeah, it is.
Let alone, you know, you're coming from the Salvation Army, right? This guy doesn't know you from Adam.
Yeah, but that helped me immensely.
Right.
It did.
I knew that this guy was sober, and he didn't use drugs or drink. Like, that's all I knew.
Yeah.
And I knew he had a car, and I knew he was, like, smiling, you know. I wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, like, I wasn't. I was in a foreign place. All the things I knew about life weren't there, and I was in a really bad place, emotionally, physically, everything.
Spiritually, especially, probably, right?
And, this guy picked me up, and I started to learn about alcoholism, and that was what he taught me. He was like, you need to learn about what you got.
Yeah.
And so I went, and I got a home group, and I did the deal. And I think, like, that deal to me was, like, just being a part of this group and talking to people before the meeting and after the meeting and still following with this program.
Right. And being such a social guy, you probably fell in love with the fellowship part of it, right?
Not at that time.
No?
No. There was a guy in my old home group, and he since moved to North Carolina. And he was like, Rick, you didn't lift your head up until you had over a year sobriety. You know, like, I just didn't have it. You
it came
know?
Slow, huh?
Yeah, I was really broken. You know, like, I just wanted to follow the rules and do what people ask, hoping and praying that my life would change. Like, something had to give.
Did it?
It did. It got slowly, right? It got slowly got better. I got out of the Salvation Army and things started coming to me. You know, my sponsor at the time was like, everything's temporary. And if you just follow the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, things will come to you.
You're going to get new sneakers.
I was going to get out, like, everything. I got found an apartment with a guy in my home group and, you know, lived with him. My first car, I was making minimum wage. I've never worked for that, like, least amount of money in my life. And I got money, and I was paying my bills. I got my license back after having to pay all these bills. And I move out of the Salvation. They give me my first job. I worked there for, like, a year and a half. And things are getting, like, better there, right? With, like, I don't know, alcoholics, they work hard. You know, or at least that's my experience.
Yep.
And like that stuff comes easy. Like getting your house back, getting food, getting clothes, and a car comes easy. It's like I'm still a mess. Like I'll be honest with you. I would say, for me, 3 years sober, 2.5 years sober, I was like, I became suicidal again. And I didn't take the steps yet. I was 2 years sober, right?
It is.
2 years sober.
Yeah.
2.5 years sober, I spoke at my old home group and nothing felt right. And I'm like, this isn't it. Like, I don't know what's going on. So I go to the 5:30 meeting at and I run into a guy that I used to party with who was a friend of mine from high school who I've seen at meetings. He used to go to a men's meeting I would go to. And he was like, hey, Rick, like, I know you. I know your story. You need the steps, dude.
I got this new drug.
And that was it. And that's like kind of how he approached me.
Right.
He grabbed my shoulder, and he was like, when you want to take the steps, give me a call.
You know what? There's so much more to becoming sober than to putting the drink in. We all know that the drugs and alcohol are a symptom of something else.
Right.
And that's what the steps are for. Mm-hmm. And so you get this guy, and you start working the steps.
And like, I called my sponsor, who I had at the time. He was out of town, and me and him had a... We went back and forth the day before on Thursday. So I call Mike, who was just here. And I was like, hey, buddy, this is where I'm at. And he knew where I was at. Like, he was like...
And for those out there listening,
wow.
Mike is the guy from episode 26.
Just prior
story,
to this.
It's available. So go ahead.
So I call him, and I tell him where I'm at. And he's like, pray and make your decision in the morning. My decision was made, right? But it's about not being reactive, right? Like not making a decision still in your emotion, right? That's like the definition of sobriety, drug and alcohol removed, is like not being reactive with my emotions. So I followed direction, and I did that. I woke up and I called this guy, hard conversation, right? I'm not a guy that's ever had hard conversations up into sobriety, and I did it, and I prayed, and I called the guy, and I was like, that fear of rejection, he's gonna like get mad at me for firing him as my sponsor, and he's like, Rick, like, if this is what you got to do, go ahead. I want you to get better. And so I asked this gentleman who was my sponsor today to be my sponsor and take me through the book. And the first thing he said to me was like, at any point you feel like you're not growing spiritually, find someone else that can help you.
Man.
And I knew that was the guy, you know? He's busy, he's got kids, he has a career. He wasn't going to be holding my hand the way that my two previous sponsors were, which is what I needed. You know, I was in Salvation Army. I needed some hand-holding. I know how to make a bed.
Right, but now
you know, I didn't know how to take
move.
A shower, brush
now
my
you're
teeth.
You're ready to make a move.
Right.
And really start working the steps.
And I do. And around that time, like I start going to therapy. And I work with the therapist and my sponsor through the steps like simultaneously, right? And she wanted to prescribe me drugs, and I wasn't against them.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that there was like stuff going on. And my sponsor was like, well, let's get through the steps. And if you still feel the same way, you should probably take the drugs or do what you think is right. How about
right,
that?
Right.
And so I was like, okay, I'm on board. I'm not against anything to feel better, like, or how better than where I'm at, you know? And I did all that, and I'm not on any medication today, you know? And I don't see that therapist today. Not that I, like, I'm open to it, you know?
Of course.
But, like, if I, like, fast forward to, like, where I'm at today, and I still see, like, yeah, I went through the steps, and I went through them kind of fast. Because I also knew, like, I had to help people. And I'm like, oh, let's get back into, like, 12-stepping and helping other people. And I did the best job I could with, like, my step with 4, 5, 6, and 7 as I could at that day. And since then, I've, like, taken another fourth, right?
I was going to say, you don't have to do them just once.
And, like, I'm in the process of doing another, you know, because there's, like, I'm the kind of guy that I start feeling better, and but I don't change anything. Man, I feel better. Life's going good. I'm making some money. I'm spiritually, I'm connected. I'm praying. I'm doing the stuff shown to me that I'm like bought into AA. You know, like I'd say from like day one, I was bought in. I knew this was going to work. So like that wasn't the thing. So I would do the thing suggested to me. And I think like recently I was like, man, I'm just in a bad place. Like, what do I do now? And the other day at the roundup, it was like time to dig in some more. Mm-hmm. Like that stuff starts pop. Those defects of character start popping up and they start control, like literally controlling me into a way that I don't know what to do about them.
So you know you've got more work to do.
100%.
Yeah.
You know, and like that's, that sucks.
Well, yeah, it does, but you know what?
Like, but you know what? You could realize that.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. And we've always got more work to do. I mean, I've been sober for 34 years. I got a lot of work
to
do.
He's got tons of work to do.
I got work to do. Just ask Brett. I got work to do.
Right. Yeah, I guess when I got to that point, I felt the same way, and I don't have it as much of sobriety as you, but I got to that point too, and what I found out was I really had to dig into 6 and 7 because right. I was still hanging on to that shit, you know, right. That, you know. So I hear you on that one. So yeah, it's good, though, that we can recognize that now.
Right, and I believe that when I'm connected, however, spiritually,
yeah.
Like that stuff will come to me, right? And I'm willing to ask other people for help, you know, and if I'm willing to like just be honest with myself and like put it out there, I know that's what saved my life from day
yeah.
one.
Like
the steps are what like helped to bring that stuff to light, right? But like the foundation of my sobriety was based on that I was willing to ask other people to talk to me, and I was willing to talk to newcomers, and I was willing to go to meetings where I didn't know anyone. I was willing to pick up other people when I got a car. And that's the stuff I think today, which is what like helps me get into the deep stuff, the childhood stuff, the steps that like really start to bring into light that there's a connection to like the guy that who I was born as, right? Like from birth, that has like some problems and issues that need to be dealt with that are like bigger than me.
You know, it all goes back to practicing a complete third step on a daily basis, right. One day at a time.
Yep.
You know, you turn your will and your life over, and things will happen for you if you genuinely do it honestly.
Right.
Things will happen for you.
And don't do it yourself, yeah.
Right, and when I sit in it and I try to, like, run the show, which I didn't, you know, I think, like, I can hear it in a meeting and people talk about, like, self-will run riot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the kind of guy that has to, like, touch the hot stove because it's hot.
Because like, you know why? Because you're like me. You learn at the speed of pain.
Right.
Right.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I've had a lot of conversations.
I know
like,
no other way.
Is like I think that's like
well,
whether
that's how we
you're.
Grow.
I think humans, alcoholic or not, like there's like two ways, right? You can go through pain and grow,
right?
Or you can like sit in pain and not grow, and like that's it, you know,
and
burn up, or like you can take it as like this is presented to me as an opportunity for growth. And I think for a while recently, I was like, this is where I'm at. I'm useless. I suck. I present nothing to the world until like a few days ago when I was like, that's not true.
There's
Milo thinks the same.
There's Milo. He's in a lot of our podcasts.
He's celebrating.
He's always guessing. I think he's telling you that you're doing well.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Brett, do you have anything else? We're kind of almost at the end of an hour.
No,
here.
I just, you know, I'm sit here always in awe. Of I hear where we go, and then I hear the wisdom, the sense of just, I don't know, man. It's a magical thing. It just is, and it strikes me every time I sit here and hear one of these stories that, man, we are good people. We're smart. We're worth it, right? And how amazing. How amazing. There's only one reason we got that, and that's through the program and the fellowship and you know, what we're doing right now, sharing this with others.
Right.
So they can see, yeah. So they, but you know, when we share these stories, people can see a way out and maybe they'll want to come here. So,
yeah. Your story is fantastic.
Oh my God.
Thanks so much for coming in and sharing.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you guys. Thanks for honor and a privilege to,
until next time on the Glum Lot Podcast, I'm Mark.
And I'm Brett.
And I'm Ricky.
As we wrap up another episode of the Glum Lot Podcast, we want to extend our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in today. Navigating the path to recovery from alcohol and other substances is a journey filled with challenges, triumphs, and self-discovery.
Remember, we're not affiliated with Alcoholics Anonymous, but we're here to provide a safe space for open conversations about the complexities of recovery. Your stories, courage, and resilience inspire us and our listeners alike. If you or someone you know is on the transformative journey, know that you're not alone. Join us next time as we continue to explore the diverse facets of recovery. Until then, stay strong, stay connected, and remember that each day is a step towards a brighter, sober tomorrow. Thank you for being part of the Glumlot community.